Hey everyone, David here. Politically Sound is on a short break, but we wanted to take this opportunity to bring you some of the other amazing political content we have here at CNN Audio. So today, I'm happy to share with you an episode of my friend David Axelrod's podcast, The Axe Files. In this episode, he sits down with the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, to discuss her journey from the small, segregated town of Baker, Louisiana, to representing the United States at the United Nations. So I hope you enjoy this excellent conversation, and we'll talk to you again soon.
And now, from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN Audio, The Axe Files, with your host, David Axelrod.
I sat down this week at the Institute of Politics with Linda Thomas-Greenfield, the new U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, whose personal journey from her childhood in the segregated South in small town Louisiana to her distinguished 35-year career in the Foreign Service is a remarkable story. We talked about that and the many urgent issues on her plate today. Here's that conversation. Ambassador Linda Thomas-Greenfield, it's great to be with you. Welcome to the Institute of Politics and welcome to the Axe Files.
Well, thank you very much. I'm really delighted to be here. I mean, it's such an honor for me.
Well, and likewise, there's so much to talk about, but I want to start with your own story. It's a long way from Baker, Louisiana, to the rarefied air of the United Nations. And tell me a little bit about your family and growing up in Baker during a very fraught time there in the 50s and 60s when the civil rights movement was really growing.
You know, Baker is a small rural town just outside of Baton Rouge. So when I meet people and they ask me where I'm from, I usually will say Baton Rouge unless they know Louisiana. But we lived kind of isolated, segregated environment. I have to say that in my early years as a little kid running around our little rural town, I didn't understand or see or feel racism because I was in a community that embraced me. I was going to a segregated school where the teachers lived in our community and the teachers embraced us. My friends were in the community with me. So it was comfortable, to be honest, comfortable in the sense that I didn't get that daily worry about being confronted with racism. But that said, my parents were living every day with the challenges of racism. My mother was a maid in the early years working for white families. Crosses were being burned in our communities on the weekend, sort of give us the message to stay in our place. But again, as a little kid, you don't see the threat of all of that. I only started to understand the threat as I started to move outside of our community.
And you're a descendant of your great great grandmother was the daughter of a enslaved person, and your folks I don't think got much formal education.
No, my grandmother, great-grandmother lived in the house with us. It was my father's grandmother, Mary, and she was born in 1865, and she died in 1965 at 100 years old. And my biggest regret in life is that I didn't have the wherewithal to ask her questions about her life. I just never thought about it, and every day I regret that I didn't talk to her more about how she started and where she came from. My father was taken out of school when he was in third grade to work on his family's, to work for his family. They didn't have a farm, but they had gardens, and his father passed away. So he was the oldest son, and he had to help out. And I didn't realize until I was in probably high school that he couldn't read because he was so smart and he was so intelligent. And He kept it from us. My mother could read. She went to school till eighth grade in the town that she grew up in, a black school. Stopped at eighth grade. So if you wanted to go beyond eighth grade, you had to move away. And so she stopped at eighth grade. She did, and I'm very proud of her for this. She since passed away, but she went back to high school and graduated in 1989 from the segregated high school that I never had an opportunity to go to. It was the white school when I graduated in 1970. In 1989, it was integrated, and my mother graduated with the 1989 graduating class.
And, you know, I wonder, given that history, about a couple of things. One is how you reacted yesterday when we saw the results of this trial in Minneapolis. And you must have been watching it attentively, as we all were. What were your feelings about it when that verdict came in?
Well, first of all, it was very emotional, and I was sitting in a room by myself and realized I couldn't watch it alone. And so I went into a room with two other people, and I was holding my breath because I didn't know what to expect. I didn't know whether justice would be served. And that's the experience that so many African Americans experience, that we don't know whether justice will be served for us. And as the mother of a son, George Floyd could have been my son. Any of these young black men who were killed so violently could have been my son. And every single time I watch him being choked to death, I thought that could have been my own baby. And I know that every single black parent felt the same way. That could have been our son, it could have been our brother, it could have been our father, it could have been someone connected to us. So we all felt somewhat connected to that. And so after the verdict was announced, I breathed a sigh of relief, but it was a brief sigh of relief, because this is just the beginning of justice being brought for so many young men who have experienced this. And I remember thinking, of course, he was vilified. And I was talking to a friend who was vilifying him in front of me. And I said, so if he passed a fake $20 bill, is that a death sentence? You can't vilify people for making mistakes in life and then get a death sentence for it. So I do think the decision that the jury made was the right decision, and it gives relief to all of us who watched.
You created a bit of a stir a couple of weeks ago by speaking very openly and honestly about the legacy of race right back to the founding of the Republic. You said, I've seen for myself how the original sin of slavery weaved white supremacy into our founding documents and principles, but I also shared these stories to offer up an insight, a simple truth I've learned over the years. Racism is not the problem of the person who experiences it, which is a really interesting observation. Former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo jumped on you for this, said it was reprehensible that you were running down the country and so on. What was your reaction to his comments?
I actually didn't hear his comments, but someone did tell me what he said. And all anyone has to do is turn on CNN. I'm not exposing some government secret about racism in America. It is a fact. It is something we live every single day. And if we can't acknowledge it, who else should acknowledge it? We have a constitution that says a black man is only 3/5 of a person. We have a constitution that was written by slave owners. Now, I will give them credit that that document has survived in ways that have brought freedoms and opportunity for all of us. And our founding fathers need to be commended for that. But they also need to be called out for where they had shortcomings. And there were shortcomings that were there. I can say without a doubt that I am the proudest American that anyone will ever see at the United Nations, because not only am I proud of my country, I acknowledge my country's weaknesses, and I am an example of what can be achieved in spite of those weaknesses. And I think that's a very powerful statement for America on the world stage.
So how did this passion of yours begin? I understand there was some sort of outpost in Baker for the, was it the Peace Corps, or that first got you thinking, hey, maybe this is something I want to do?
You know, that's interesting, because over many years I was asked how I became interested in foreign affairs. And it was only later in life that I really look back and recall my experience with the Peace Corps. The Peace Corps came to my community in the mid-60s, just as Peace Corps was beginning, and they were training to go to Somalia and Swaziland. And there were young kind of white hippies. One of them eventually would end up being my boss in the Foreign Service. It's a small world. So these hippies and a couple of young African-Americans and then Africans from Swaziland and Somalia in this little segregated community where we had a old HBCU that had closed down. And they open up so many doors of our minds. I had never even heard anything about Africa. Whatever we heard about Africa, it was Tarzan. We hadn't experienced the real Africa. We hadn't experienced the real people of Africa. And Peace Corps brought that to our community. And in addition to bringing that to our community, they challenged the order of the day. They insisted that they be allowed to go to the local washateria. And I know many of your students don't know what a washateria is, but you, most people use those. They insisted that they be allowed with their African teachers and African Americans to use the local washateria that had a for whites only sign on the front door. They insisted on going into restaurants. And so they opened doors for us that we ourselves never thought could be open. And I have always been thankful for that experience.
You went to LSU, not a historically black college. That must have been challenging at that time in history.
1970, and it was. And I had no clue what I was going to face there. But from day one, when I moved into my dormitory, my roommate was black, and we were two black girls on a floor with all white girls. And every single hall in our dormitory only had two black girls on each hallway. And we could never room with anyone else. And even my second year, I ended up rooming alone because there was not another black girl to room with me. I've talked about the fact that David Duke was on campus at that time preaching the same hatred that he's preaching today, the same white supremacy that has brought us to the place we are today. There, he only had the platform of Free Speech Alley that was outside the union. Today, he has a world platform through social media and through internet.
You had this notion that you were going to, you went off to public administration school at the University of Wisconsin. You had this notion that you might go to law school. And then you took a different path. Why?
Because the path was put in front of me. So I had not intended to go to graduate school. But I didn't know how I was going to get to law school. I knew I needed money and I was going to work and I was trying to figure out how I was going to do it. And this was put in front of me as an opportunity. And I took advantage of it. And I always say to young people, don't stare an opportunity in the face because you're looking for another opportunity.
When you say this, explain what you mean was put in front of you as an opportunity.
So I had a professor at LSU who had gone to the University of Wisconsin, and she asked what I planned to do. And I told her I plan to go to law school, not quite sure how I'm going to do it. I'm going to work a couple of years and see if I can save some money, get a scholarship. And she said, well, the University of Wisconsin has this amazing one-year master's degree program, and there's a scholarship that I think you would qualify for. So she helped me apply for this scholarship, and I had no clue I was going to get accepted. I just took advantage of it because it was put in front of me, and I got accepted into the University of Wisconsin, and the rest is history. And I'm so happy I walked through that door.
Yeah, different world up there than LSU.
Oh, yeah. But I will tell you something, though. The only place, the first time ever in my life, and I've told this to my friends at Wisconsin, that the N-word was ever thrown at me was in Madison, Wisconsin.
Really?
It never happened in Louisiana.
Huh. That's interesting. Racism does not have boundaries.
No.
You decided to pursue a doctoral degree. Somewhere in there, you took a year's trip to do research in Liberia,
yes.
Which is, of course, is a country that was formed by freed enslaved people from America in 1820. What impact did that have on you? You talked earlier about what just learning about Africa did for you. What did it mean for you to go to Liberia?
Well, the first thing, I still remember the Pan Am flight flying over the coast of Liberia as we were about to land, and the emotions that I felt as an African-American going back to where I knew I had ancestors somewhere. I didn't know from where, but I knew they came from that continent. So I felt very emotional. And then once landing there and starting to live there, not being a minority for the first time in my life, because everybody was Black. So I felt the emotions of being included in the country and looking like everyone else. So it did have a major impact on my life.
You joined the Foreign Service and you spent, 12 years in various postings in Africa. Tell me about the decision to join the Foreign Service. I know somewhere along the way you acquired a husband out of the deal who was also in the Foreign Service. But tell me about that decision in those 12 formative years.
Well, I intended to go into academics. So after I concluded my research in Liberia, I went back to Wisconsin to write my dissertation. And like many ABD PhD students, I kind of hit a lull. Like I wrote 3 chapters and I just froze. So my professor, a wonderful man by the name of Crawford Young, suggested I go off and teach for a couple of years or a year and then come back and finish the dissertation. And I took his advice and went off to teach at Bucknell University and realized that that was not my passion at the time. I have changed since, but it was not my passion. And I had taken the Foreign Service exam just without a commitment to going into the Foreign Service. And I passed the exam. I passed the oral exam in Chicago. I came to the federal building there for my oral. And so then I thought, well, maybe let me look into this. And I was in the process of getting married to someone who was in the Foreign Service, and it made a lot of sense to me. And here I am.
35 years in the in the Foreign Service in various capacities, including postings as ambassador. You were the ambassador to Kenya, I believe.
No, Liberia.
No, I served in Kenya. Okay, you served in Kenya. So in 1994, you made a trip to Rwanda that was really meaningful to you and really underscored the need for diversity in the Foreign Service. Tell me about what happened.
You know, Dan, these things that change your life. I went to Rwanda to do an assessment of Burundi refugees and the programs that we were supporting for those refugees. And a genocide happened while I'm there. And I kind of got caught in the crossfire in the sense that as these genocidaires were looking for the people they wanted to kill, and they started out with a list of people they wanted to kill, And one of those people happened to be the acting prime minister, who was a Hutu, who lived next door to the deputy chief of mission, our deputy ambassador, where I was staying. And when they went to her house, they didn't find her. And they assumed that she'd come next door because we had actually tried to help her cross the wall into our residence, thinking it would save her life. We failed at helping her cross the wall. I'll never understand. And I think because she didn't cross the wall, I'm here to talk about it. But when they didn't find her, they came into our residence looking for her. And they stormed into the residence and they looked at me. And as soon as they looked at me, I knew they saw her. I immediately knew. And, you know, I kind of had this holy crap moment of they think I'm her. So I took out my passport and I started yelling in French, "I'm not the person you're looking for. I'm in America and I live in Kenya." And I'm kind of attacking this guy with my passport. I live to tell the story, as I said. There's much more to it. But when I came out of it, I came out of it with kind of two things. One, they didn't know that I was an American diplomat because they're not used to seeing a Black diplomat. And that's not good. And secondly, that sometimes, and I always talk about the importance of kindness. So this person who was holding the gun on me, I talked to him. I asked him his name, and unfortunately, I forgot his name. But I also wanted him to know my name, because I thought he was going to kill me. And I thought, you know, if he kills me, he needs to know who he killed. I don't want him to ever forget my name. And so I told him my name and kind of had a conversation with him. They would eventually leave. And as I said, the story is much longer.
Yeah.
But I've never forgotten the impact that it had.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with more of the Axe Files. And now, back to the show. You became the chief of the Foreign Service, and you were a force for promoting diversity. But by the way, we could talk about the failures of the U.S. in Rwanda, which were legion, and I'm sure also taught you some lessons, but we got limited time. And you were a champion for diversity in the Foreign Service, and for basically for the rights of minorities and women around the world, women.
Yes.
Being particularly abused in many places in the world. It leads me to a question about current policy in Afghanistan. We are leaving Afghanistan by September 11th. That is the decision of the president. There is a lot of concern about what happens if the Taliban come back and are resurgent and reimpose the really, really oppressive policies toward women that existed before the Taliban were overthrown with the help of the American government. What do you say to folks who are concerned about that as someone who's been a lifelong champion of women's rights?
And you may not know this, rarely shown in my bio, but I actually worked in Pakistan for 3 years, focused on working with Afghan refugees in the late 90s and traveled regularly to Afghanistan with a primary goal of promoting the rights of women and girls. So what I say to those women and girls right now and to all Afghan people, we have so many tools in our toolkit. The military is just one component. We will continue to engage both politically and diplomatically with Afghanistan, with the government of Afghanistan, and with the people of Afghanistan. And we will continue to press and push for women's rights and for the rights of girls and for human rights in Afghanistan. our military went into Afghanistan 20 years ago to ensure that Afghanistan did not continue to be a safe haven. We accomplished that goal. And so we have continued to build opportunities in that country through our diplomatic and our political tools. We will continue to.
Yeah, you know, Ambassador, that is all true. Everything you said is true. But, and, you know, there's been a lot of reporting on this, and I'm sure you've heard personally, there are a lot of women there who feel abandoned. They're very frightened about what is going to happen next. You must have concerns about that.
You know, I'm always concerned about the impact of violence and policies against women globally. I raise this issue in the Security Council on a regular basis. We're looking at the situation, for example, in Ethiopia,
yes,
where rape is being used as a tool of war. I saw the impact of Liberian women, including electing a woman as president, and we have supported those efforts. And we will continue to support Afghan women as they fight for their rights. And again, I know that it will always be an uphill battle because women's rights are always compromised in situations of conflict. But they should know that we will be standing with them.
The other thing that's percolating right now is the issue of refugee policy and a question as to whether the president has gone back on a commitment he made to lift the cap of 15,000, very, very low cap that President Trump put on the allowable number of refugees admitted to the country. President Biden said by before October that there would be 62,500 refugees allowed in, and he wanted to double that in the next fiscal year. But the other day, the decision came down that the cap was going to remain for now because of immigration issues at the border. Why should people not? There's a lot of anger about it. Should people not feel a bit of a betrayal on this?
Absolutely not. I think the president's commitment to refugees and humanitarian programs is very, very clear. And we see this as a first step in opening up the refugee processing program. But we see those numbers increasing, and the president has made that clear in his response to questions about this. I have worked on refugee programs. That rarely shows up in my career bio. But more than 15 years, I worked on refugee programs, starting with resettlement programs. And it takes an extraordinarily well-oiled infrastructure to bring refugees in, to support them once they arrive, and help them integrate in the United States. That was destroyed during the Trump administration over the past 4 years. We're rebuilding that infrastructure. And I know that we will continue to see the president's honored the commitment that he's made.
And I don't mean to run you through through talking points. That's not useful for either of us. But
these are mine.
But he, I'm not saying that. I'm not suggesting otherwise. But you know, there was a piece this morning in the Times that said the Secretary of State went in and tried to make the case to the president to raise the cap, and he had gone up to the Hill and said that would happen. It feels like something went off the rails a little bit here. Is that not right?
No, I don't think that's right. I think we're looking at what we can do at this point in time. Mm-hmm. But the president is clear the numbers are going to increase. So I don't think that's right. I think people need to watch what the president does over the coming weeks and months.
Yeah. Maybe the best thing here is to say the situation was different than what we thought we were going to walk into. And you know, the intent is the same. And we want to do it as soon as is humanly possible. Probably
Absolutely.
Is the most honest. I'm not suggesting you're not being honest, but I just from the beginning, I can't help but going back to my old life, you know, and kibitzing about message.
Yes.
You've got a big couple of days coming up right now. The president is holding a virtual climate summit with leaders from all over the world to try and get accelerate heading into the next big climate meeting in Glasgow later this year, accelerate what was done in Paris. You've rejoined the Paris Accord. Tell me what you hope is going to be accomplished in these 2 days.
Thank you for that question, because I'm actually on my way to Washington tonight, where I will be participating and moderating a panel with Secretary Austin on the security implications of climate change. And what the president hopes to achieve over the next 2 days is to, I think, reaffirm our commitment to climate and really challenge other countries to reaffirm their commitments and make those commitments even more ambitious than we have had in the past. We are losing time. We know that climate impacts all of us, all over the world. And here at the United Nations, this is an issue that I will be working on and addressing over the coming months leading up to the Glasgow conference, because it's a global issue. And I need to work with all of the members of the Security Council to get them to really firm up and recommit to dealing with what we all will have to face if we don't address climate change today.
I spoke yesterday to the climate minister of another country, and he asked me, he said, we have no question about President Biden's commitment, but we have questions about America's ability to stick to President Biden's commitments, because President Obama made commitments, then there was a change of administration, and there was a backsliding on all of this and the withdrawal from the Paris Accord. How do you regain trust? And I think this is a question not just about climate, but about a lot of issues that you personally are going to be dealing with as you talk to your colleagues from around the world.
It's a challenge to regain trust, but I think everything that we have done in the 100 days of the Biden administration shows the world that we're back and that we're committed. And I have to say, here in New York, I've been warmly embraced. I've been embraced by our adversaries. I've been embraced by our allies, because the U.S. voice is an important voice. We did, over the past 4 years, gave the world a reason to question our commitments. But we're back, and we're really working to reaffirm that. And I think the important thing is that we really have to firm up those commitments. And I would say, even on the climate change, where the government stepped back, private sector and state governments continue to move forward. So people still saw that America had not turned its back completely on climate change or on the world.
Yeah. It's been reported that the president's going to actually increase our goal by 2030 significantly, from 30% under 2005 levels of emissions to 50%, cutting them that much. The question the guy was asking me, who I spoke with, was what happens if a Republican administration comes in, and what assurance does the world have that the U.S. will stay on that path?
You know, I think that's a good question. And I think that, again, they have to look at what happened during the past 4 years, where our private sector didn't turn back the clock, and our state governments didn't turn back, and American people broadly didn't turn it back. And so I think it's incumbent upon us to continue to build on what we're doing during this 4 years, so that it's harder for a different administration to turn things around as quickly as Trump. That caught all of us by surprise. And so I think we will do everything possible to make it harder to do that next time around.
You know, the other thing that comes up is China. And they're the biggest emitter in the world, almost twice as much as we emit at this point. They have over 1,000 coal mines, and they're building more. a real emphasis on their economic development. How do you, what leverage do you have? I mean, are the Chinese even going to participate in this summit?
They did announce that they were going to participate. And we actually see this as an area where we can find some synergies with the Chinese and some cooperation with them on climate change. They know the impact of climate change. If you've ever gone to Beijing on those days when you can barely see the air in front of you, they know that this is impacting them, and they know that they have to address the issues of climate change if their country is to continue to grow and survive. And that's one of the areas where I have engaged with the Chinese here in New York. Secretary or Special Envoy Kerry was in China, and it's through his efforts that he has brought the Chinese on board. We will continue to work with them to get them to make commitments that will help us deal with this.
They did acknowledge in what was some critics said was kind of an anodyne statement, but they did acknowledge that this was a crisis, and that's an important, important word. The question is, you know, whether they're intent on delaying action as they pursue their economic plans between now and 2030, and whether it'll be too late for them to get serious about these goals if the global climate targets are going to be met.
And that's why we have to ramp up our efforts. That's why this conference that we're having over the next 2 days is so important as a first step of getting to the next conference in later this year. To continue to keep the pressure on China as well as other countries to honor their commitments and up their ambitions and to hold them accountable for what they're doing on the environment. We can't delay this.
Presumably to signal that we've upped our ambitions as well.
Yes, yes.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with more of the Axe Files. And now, back to the show. You're going to do a session with Secretary Austin.
Yes.
On the national security, not national, but the security elements of climate. Tell me a little bit about that.
You know, we have a number of countries. The Kenyan defense minister is participating, for example, and I know her quite well. We have seen the impact of climate on security. You just have to look at what's happening, for example, in the Sahel, where the social and economic impact of climate has had an impact on insecurity in this region. It's impacting migration flows in Africa as well as in other places in the world. So the idea is to look at how climate is impacting security and how we can start to address those issues. We will also have Avril Haines participating, looking at...
National Intelligence Director, yeah.
Yes, looking at how our intel can assess the impact of climate in certain areas of the world. I think this is going to be an important discussion. And I think it will highlight for so many people what they don't connect. They don't connect climate always to insecurity.
And is the target America of your messages?
No, the target is the world. We're going to have participants from several other countries participating in this. And the target is the globe.
Before I let you go, I have to ask you about Russia. There are so many fraught elements of our relationship right now. The president expelled some of their diplomats. They expelled some of ours. President Putin has imprisoned Alexei Navalny. He apparently is very ill and is not getting the attention he needs. There are Russian troops massed on the border of Ukraine. What options are there for America, and what are you doing? How are you dealing with this at the UN.
President Biden said when he made the announcement and after his call to Putin, we want a stable and predictable relationship with Russia, and that a stable and predictable relationship provides security for all of us and for everyone across the world. And so part of my job here in New York is to promote that stable and predictable relationship, because I have almost, as a member of the Security Council, a member of the P5, I have regular engagements with my Russian counterpart. And we don't want to escalate what is happening now. The president made clear that we had no choice but to respond to Russian attacks on our electoral process. But we also want to look for those areas where we can have a relationship of that is predictable for the rest of the world. And we will be working here in New York to try to enhance those areas where we can cooperate, but we will not shy away from letting the Russians know if we have some issues that cause us problems with them.
Yeah, I mean, if Navalny dies, if the Russians move on Ukraine, that's a big strategic challenge for us.
It absolutely is. And it's something that we're watching very, very closely. And should that happen, I think we, again, will be put in a place where we have to have some tough discussions, additional tough discussions with the Russians on the way forward, if there is one.
Tell me about your view of the United Nations as an institution. It has taken a lot of incoming. There are situations like the one in Ukraine where the question is, how much leverage does the UN actually have in averting aggression between countries? Make the case for the institution and what needs to happen there to strengthen the institution.
The United Nations is the only global institution that we have in the world dating back to World War II where we can address global issues. And while it has not always succeeded in addressing those issues the way we would like them to address those issues, it provides a forum where we can at least come together and try to find solutions for dealing with these tough issues like what is happening in Ukraine or Burma or Yemen or Syria. And occasionally we actually hit the sweet spot where all of us come together and actually find a solution. It's tough work because you're dealing with countries that have different interests and they bring their interests to the table, and those interests are not always our interests. And we're constantly trying to work within the context of competing national interests. But again, I think that every country, every member state of the United Nations see this organization as important in getting issues and crises dealt with in an acceptable way to people in the world. And I can tell you that people want to hear our voices. When we make a statement on Burma, the people of Burma are listening. When we make a statement on Syria, as I did today, I know the people of Syria are listening, and we give them strength by our support. The fact that we're able to sit in a global forum and express our support for what is happening.
One of the controversies that you have confronted is the decision to rejoin the Human Rights Council, which the U.S. withdrew from under the Trump administration because of the perception, not the perception, because of, you know, a persistent anti-Israeli focus of the council and the fact that a lot of human rights abusers were well represented on the council and the hypocrisy of that. And how do you respond to all of that?
If we're not at the table, those human rights abusers are empowered at the table. And our power and our ability to push back is felt. And our decision to leave the council was felt by those people who look to us for our voices, and particularly as it relates to Israel, because we were able to push back. And while we didn't succeed in getting every single attack on Israel stopped, we were able to decrease the number of attacks. And that is going to be one of our highest priorities when we rejoin the Security Council. And I think we have some new opportunities. Israel has developed new relationships that came out of the Abraham Accord with countries in the Middle East. It is my hope that we can use those new relationships to decrease the unfair targeting of Israel in the context of the Human Rights Council, as well as at the United Nations.
Do you think some of the criticism is fair?
No. What we have seen is that the criticism is unfair. When Israel does things that require criticism, we will criticize Israel. But the way the Human Rights Council has addressed Israel, there's a separate chapter, Article 7, that allows Israel to be addressed at every single Security Council meeting. That doesn't happen with any other country. We all have issues that we want to bring to the table about every country, but Israel is the only country where they're actually on the agenda all the time. And that has to stop. We're not saying Israel can't be criticized if they do something that we disagree with, but what we're saying is Israel can't be the only country that gets this kind of targeted, focused criticism that no other country ever experiences on the Security Council. And our place will be there to defend Israel.
There's so much to talk about in so little time. It's so great to be with you. Thank you so much for joining today.
Good. Thank you very much. And again, I'm so honored to have this opportunity to sit with you.
Well, I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to the Axe Files, brought to you by the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN Audio. The executive producer of the show is Emily Stanitz. The show is also produced by Miriam Annenberg, Jeff Fox, Hannah McDonald, and Allison Siegel. And special thanks to our partners at CNN, including Courtney Coop, Ashley Lusk, and Megan Marcus. For more programming from the IOP, visit politics.uchicago.edu.